right, let us go to the Skype hotline here. Last time that I talked to Jennifer Bryson, she was here in the U.S., and she was... She was a woman in between rocks and hard places. Jennifer, you're in Austria now. What town are you in Austria?
I am in Heiligenkreuz in the Viennese forest. So outside of Vienna in a small town with a population of 517.
Where is that in regards to Vienna?
So I'm just a little bit southwest of Vienna. By car, it's half an hour, public transportation, 90 minutes to 2 hours. And I live next door to a large, vibrant Cistercian monastery.
So I was wondering, so now are you third order there?
No, I'm not. I'm a visiting researcher at their school of theology. And I live next door in the town.
So is that where Charles Coulomb is a visiting researcher?
He is in Vienna, I believe.
Okay. All right. So when you and I talked 2 years ago, you were in between taking the pantsuit and the shoulder pads and throwing it in the fire. You had realized tragically that you had been lied to with the feminism, and yeah, you had pursued it most of your life. And then you came to the event horizon moment where I'm too old to become a mother. You could become a wife, but too old to become a mother. And maybe too old to become a sister. And that's where we left it last time I talked to you. So now, and then I turn around and you're in Austria. How does this happen?
First about being in Austria, is I'm visiting here for 2 years and I'm translating the works of a fabulous mid-20th century Catholic writer. I'm translating her works from German to English. Her name is Ida Friederike Göris. And she's hardly known in English, although she was well known to great publishers like Sheet and Ward back in the 30s. And she wrote a lot on family and marriage and also a great deal on the church. And one of her great specialties was on sanctity. And about this question of being a woman, you know, my 50s, I really think the church has an issue it's going to have to deal with, that so many women were raised on the lies and poison of feminism and secularism. That's all I knew growing up before I converted. And then all of a sudden, you've got all these women who are a bit older, and yet all of our models are based on young people being raised in the faith and discovering their vocations when they're young. And our society is all out of joint right now.
Well, they're not discovering their vocations when they're young, because vocations basically are now taught K through 12. This is how you raise the next generation of factory workers, or in this case, next generation of office cubicle workers to toil away at digital projection screens. There's no education that's going on there. It's on and it's a poor on the job. It's poor job training.
Yeah, and they tell young people that the meaning and purpose in life is career, especially to girls. And there's so much more going on in God's creation.
So, I have a pair of twin daughters. Well, they're twins. Of course, they're a pair. I have a pair of daughters who are the same age, and they're 24. After you and I spoke, I sent both of them our interview. I don't know if either one of them watch it. I think not, because their past didn't change. But I see exactly the same thing. And look, I became aware of it when they were in high school, and it was too late. What I would say to people that have young children, you got to get them when they're young. You got to start this when they're young. Because even though I tried to administer the corrective when they were like 15, 16 years old, I had no shot. No shot whatsoever. And I still, now they tell me the research says that if it's the father that converts and tries to live the holy ascetic good life of a Catholic man, that something like 75-80% chance that the children who are falling away, especially the daughters, will follow. I'm not saying that they're not following yet. They're not wandering away, but they're not following yet. So this has to be done when they're young.
Yeah. I agree. You know, in the article you and I talked about last time was an article in which I wrote down the career advice I give to young women or maybe college students just out of college who would often come to me for career advice because in many work situations, I was one of fewer women. And when I would sit down and tell them, okay, the single most important thing you can do in your life right now is to get married and have children. Or if you're Catholic, you need to invest time in discerning your vocation. They're completely shocked. They want me to tell them which graduate school to go to, how to go up the career ladder.
Right.
And by that point, it's a difficult conversation to have.
So have you had successful, difficult conversations with any young women? Or have you gone to any schools? Do we have any success stories to share?
Actually, I have had some wonderful, successful conversations. And in every case I can remember, the women I thought were almost going to break down crying because their hearts told them that they were designed as women for, you know, being wives and mothers. And this can include education, of course, but in the context of that structure that God gives us, a family. And they were so incredibly relieved to have somebody say to them, it's okay to want to be a wife. It's okay to want to be a mother, because everybody else around them is telling them career, career, career.
So, well, let me ask, so you're in Austria now. Is there any difference between that old part of Europe, and it was a major part of Christendom at one time, and where we are in the U.S.? Are they pretty much the same?
Actually, I do find that there's more of an intuitive sense here that the family unit of one man, one woman being married and probably having children, although here it's likely to be just one or two, is very widespread birth control. There's still an intuitive sense that there's something normal about that, and that's sort of in the order of things. For example, I find that the transgenderism craze is not as wildly dangerous and off the rails as it is in the United States. But at the same time, the Christian faith and the Catholic Church here has been in a state of somewhat of collapse.
Mm.
And in the article that I sent you this week that led to our conversation today, I mentioned in there a sermon where the priest, Father Florian Mayerhofer, talked about how it's like the groundwater level of the water table of faith in society has gotten so low that even people who are seeking don't find it in public. And so Catholics here are starting to really realize that they've got to go out into public with their faith and be part of the public to reach people.
Jennifer Bryson is on our Dude Maker Skype line here with us live from Austria. I'm not even going to try to pronounce the name of the town that you said you were in. Although, I'm sure if I hear it another time or two. I was able to get Alexander Tshugwell out after only a couple of attempts, and he actually had me speaking some German by the end. So maybe by the end, are you speaking German? Or it's mostly German, or is it French?
German.
And by the way, if you meet Sir Charles Cologne, you can talk to him in German. He speaks pretty good German.
I haven't met him yet, but it's a small world here.
Well, you know, pretend like you're in Austria and talk to him in German and see if he goes, ah, Fräulein, you're an American German. See if he picks up on it. That would be a fun exercise. All right, I want to start with Austrian Catholics launched public rosary in response to lockdowns, published at Crisis Magazine by our friend Eric Sammons. Let me start here. In 1940, in the little village of Boulogne on the northern coast of France, a statue, a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful statue of Our Lady reappeared. And a new devotion came up to her, Our Lady of Boulogne. And because she had been gone, and she had reappeared twice before in the past, and had presaged, her appearance had presaged, I don't want to say comebacks, but rekindling of vibrancy and tradition in the faith and devotion. So she reappears. She appears again in 1940 or so in the small village of Boulogne. And she's called because of an apparition 600 years earlier, Our Lady of Boulogne. Well, the priest that's in the village there gets inspired by Our Lady. I'm not sure if she appeared to him or not. And they start doing processions around Boulogne. And they spread to the other towns. And before long, 150,000 people are following. And now she's known to us as is Notre Dame de la Grand Retour, Our Lady of the Grand Return. And look, it was working. The places where she was going in France were spared from Nazi, from many Nazi aggressions. The French did not have their sacraments taken away. There were many miracles. I didn't see an apparition or a Marian statue here. So, but you do start your story in 1940 or so with another Austria Praise Initiative. So. Is this similar to Our Lady of Boulogne and the Grand Return?
Wow, that's a great story. There are similarities, especially in that it starts small, taking the rosary out into public, and people are incredibly hungry, and it starts springing up all over. So the history here in Austria is that there was a Catholic priest, Father Petrus Pavlicek, who had been a prisoner of war during World War II in an American camp where he first heard about the apparitions in Fatima. Fast forward, in the late 40s, he goes on a pilgrimage to a place called Mariazell and thanksgiving for two things. For two reasons. One is thanksgiving for being released from detention, but also to pray for Austria. Because at this point in the late 40s, Austria is under occupation. And during his pilgrimage, he hears, he's told, do what I tell you and there'll be peace. He recognizes the echo to Fatima and he starts a rosary prayer group. And this grows, and by 1950, he starts a rosary crusade. And he does it in public because, you know, keep in mind, when Austria is being occupied, one of the occupying powers is the Soviet Union.
Right, right.
This was the only area of Europe that was occupied by the Soviet Union that the Soviet Union withdrew from. And the occupation was very brutal, property taken, violence, rapes of women. It was a terrible crisis in Austria. He thought, politics won't get us out. We've got to pray about this in public. An important, interesting point here, when he starts this in 1950, the bishop is opposed to his initiative.
Of course he is.
In Vienna. But he does it anyways, and he starts an annual rosary procession in public in Vienna. And it's on the feast of Our Lady's Name.
Right.
It was in September. And this grew and grew until 1955. They estimate there were over 500,000 people in the procession. There's an amazing photo of it still available. And major politicians started participating. Interesting. And 1955, there was an agreement and the occupying powers left. So today, Austria is in a crisis. And many Austrians look back to realizing that praying the rosary in public, seeking intercession of Our Lady, was how they fought and how they got out of a crisis.
So now there's a case for the canonization of Father Pavlicek?
It's been submitted to Rome from the diocese.
So are there miracles?
I don't know of the details of his case, but I know that he's very well known here, and he's a figure that many Austrians look up to, especially right now, because you were asking earlier about comparisons between the U.S. and Austria on, marriage and family. Well, on the issue of politics and pandemic restrictions, Austria is much more, I find, it's very tense right now, and the restrictions are much more far-reaching than in the U.S.
Okay, Jennifer Bryson on our SkyMaker hotline, getting a rundown of what's going on in Austria, what's happened in the past, and what's going on today. All right, folks, you're going to love this story. You're going to love the story I'm going to tell you, but you're going to love this story that Jennifer's going to tell you next, because the initiative that we have been working on for partner about 2 years, but in some way, shape, or form, probably in the last eight or so, is that there is simply there is no redemption to be found in governments that are founded upon the authority of we the people. On the authority of, you know, of democracy, that without a return to where when the state and the church come into clash, if it's a matter of faith, doctrine, or morals in public or in private, that the church's rule is going to triumph here. Without that, we have no hope. And that I'm basically showing you on Crusade TV, this is the social kingship of Christ. He's above. He's always super. We're always sub. He's always super, always sub. Without this combination, it won't work. You'll be right back where we are today. Maybe it'll go away for a little while. It will return. So once we establish this, then what we talk about here and what have been talking about in earnest now for a year and a half is it all comes down to the family. Comes back down to the family, and it comes down to men returning to be conversion, reversion, whatever, inspiration, returning to be good Catholic men, fathers, husbands, and leaders, priest, king, and bishop, or philosopher, as G.C. Dilsaver calls it. You got to lead the household. From there, if you find these men in these households and you start knitting them together because they have a common cause now, this is from whence we win. This is how, and you're going to win in your household anyways. The most important government in the world is the one at the kitchen table. That's the most important. At the end of the day, it's the most important one. Having said that, this initiative that Jennifer's talking about, I love this story, is started by a guy that has 11 children, and he's a wine merchant in Austria. So you have to get us up to speed on who is this gentleman.
Now, his name is Louis Père Laroche. He's originally from France, married to an Austrian, and he was aware of this crisis because he was hearing about it from neighbors, from friends, from people he worked with. And he said, we've got to do something. And the best resource we have are in the deepest traditions of the church. And he knew that means the rosary. He also knew we've got to go out into public to reach the public. And he said, I'm just going to start this. He didn't have a plan. He's not part of an organization that had some huge network. He's like, I've got to start this. And after he'd prayed about it, he said, all right, my family and I and some friends, we're just going to go out into public in my town. He's in a little town of about 350 people. And once a week on Wednesday nights, we're going to go pray the rosary in public. And so he wrote down his idea and shared it with a bunch of friends. And within days, it went from dozens to hundreds of people following to now thousands of people following. And this was only 3 weeks ago. And last night on Wednesday night, I heard in Austria there were public rosary prayers in over 140 towns and cities. And people want to reach out in public and bear public witness that we've got to reach out also to the supernatural dimensions of our crisis.
So he started. Now, what I think is key here, this only makes common sense. Now, much of the evil that social media does is by design. I was telling my friend, Brother Andre Marie, yesterday, you met Brother, said, Brother, social media was designed by Satanists for Satanists. It was designed to promote progressivism. This is what they made it for. The error was, and all of us going, you, I want to jump in. It's not made for you. Now, here is what is made for you. Now, no, just think about this. Here's a father of 11, a wine merchant, who goes, I'm just going to get some people together. We're going to go and start praying in public. Wow, what a thought. Gee, if you want to get the public to rally behind you, maybe you need to go in public. Twitter is not public, and it's not reality. Facebook is not public, and it's not reality. The chat room at crusadechannel.com/chat, now it may have some reality in it, but it's not public. If you want public things to happen, you have to go in public, right?
Yes, you've got to go out into public. You know, and you know, we're praying here in Austria now every Wednesday night. So you and I are talking on Thursday. I was out last night in my town praying locally with our group that had a public procession. And every time a car drove by, I wonder what that driver's thinking. Here's a bunch of people out in this really cold weather in the dark, carrying candles, praying the rosary. It gives people pause. It gives them thought. I think it can also be a way to give people hope and encouragement when they're not going to get it from other sources.
In a video about how Austria prays, how it started, LaRoche says, I had nothing to do with the pro or anti position on various hot and button issues. Rather, everyone said now only God can help or now only prayer can help. People are ready to pray, but nobody does. Okay, well, then I'll do it. Keeping it as simple as possible so that everyone feels, yes, I can do that. It's the age-old tale. David versus Goliath, someone has to be the David, and you have to actually go like, well, I don't have a sling. Or where am I going to get a sling? Well, you can get one of these. Here's a sling. It even kind of looks like a sling, a rosary. I mean, I guess if you wanted to, you could probably find a way to, you know, tie some of the end of the beads together to make it so a rock would fit neatly in there, and, you know, use Our Lady's Psalter to to whack some giant upside the head. But it is true, and when you do it in public, it makes all that much more different. Like you said, somebody driving by going, the first thing they're going like, why are you blocking the street? I'm in a hurry. That's the first thing. I know because I've done several of these. But then you'll get the scorn. You'll get the looks like, what are you doing there? Why are you doing this? Then when they figure out what it is that you're doing, you'll get one or two reactions. You'll get a honk on the horn and a thumbs up, or you'll get the crazed, Satan-addled, pro-abort lunatics who will roll their windows down and will spout every manner of obscenity you can possibly imagine. And I've seen this with my own eyes, and this is why there were children. Children standing there with the rosaries in their hands as part of a rosary procession. And I guess the point is that it provokes a reaction either way. There's very little apathy when you see a rosary. There's almost no apathy when you see a Eucharistic procession. Now, if you see a rosary procession, and I don't know if Mr. LaRoche, if it's grown to the point where there are maybe young men that are carrying a statue of Our Lady of Fatima, or who's the patroness queen of Austria? Is there an apparition?
Well, I don't know of an apparition, but Father Pavlicek, whom I mentioned, who started this Rosary Crusade in the 50s, he wrote a hymn that is called Our Protectress of Austria. It's a Marian hymn. And so that hymn has started coming back. We've been singing that hymn both where I go to Mass and also during the processions. And another thing that I think is important about Mr. LaRoche's vision is it's not a one-time thing. We may also have to sacrifice. I mean, sometimes here in Austria right now, as I said, it's cold, dark, raining, snowing, but people are going, and we're going to have to keep going.
Maybe it's
going to take time, but we're going to keep at it.
But Jennifer, maybe it's the fact that you stopped. Does anyone go back and go like, they made us stop? Yeah. Maybe it's the fact that we stopped doing it because it used to be a regular thing. As a matter of fact, you know, one of the I have a very, very conservative, traditional, sacred tradition minded, pretty young priest here. We are so blessed. And he is steeped. Now, we can say what you want about our brethren who are Eastern Orthodox, but the Eastern have as many traditions that they carry with them that are as ingrained in their lives as some of the ones that we have. They're big into their vestments. They love their vestments. They love the Theotokos. And he's a convert from Eastern Orthodoxy. And so, you know, he brings that kind of regimented that regimented parish life of that, oh, no, it's Corpus Christi. We're doing a procession. Oh, no, it's Assumption. We're doing a procession. No. It's the kingship of Christ the day the Sunday before or whatever, before All Saints Day. I think that this is the most positive thing of all the what you and I are talking about that has come about. It's not just the one time off that we can get together. Ooh, look at the big splash we made. No, it's a life.
Yeah,
it's a life. This is something you do for life. You do always. You're always, not just because you're in trouble, because you can do the procession when you're not in trouble, can't you?
Yes, well, and look, in 1955 in Austria, when they thought they were out of trouble.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe there are troubles there that we sometimes don't see. Mm. But also, right now, the troubles in Austria are very clear, and also the tensions in society are palpable, and the church offers us a way to live peacefully together. And a society, I think, cannot sustain over the long run these types of internal tensions, and getting out there in public and having the courage to invite others to come. You know, and another thing that somebody pointed out to me about this public rosary movement is that the rosary is something that neither the state nor the church can forbid.
Yeah, and even if these rumors...
The church over the mass right now are huge.
Right. We're hearing the same thing, you and I.
Yeah.
They can't stop. Well, we're going to take the books. You ain't taking mine. hey, Padre, you're not getting my Lassance missile. you can outlaw it all you want. You're not getting it. But you're right. They can't take the rosary.
Yeah, but we can take the rosary out into public. And, you know, maybe a family has rosary prayer together every night, which I think is a beautiful family tradition. What if maybe right now, once a week, that family rosary were a walk together out in public, you know, and if it's like traditional Wednesday nights is when Austria is doing it, who knows? Maybe they'll find there's other families in the neighborhood who also pray the rosary together. And then you've got two families. Who knows where it can grow from there? Just a thought.
Well, here's the thought. Jennifer Bryson, who is now, what's the university you're doing theology studies at?
I'm at Hochschule Heiligenkreuz. Good luck pronouncing that. It's a graduate school of theology in Heiligenkreuz.
Heiligenkreuz is Holy Cross.
You did it. Exactly. Yeah. The largest relic of the crucifix of Christ north of the Alps is just a few feet away from me right now. That's why it's called Heiligenkreuz.
Heiligenkreuz. You know, there's a place in Lithuania. I don't know if you've been to Lithuania. The Hill of the Cross. Have you ever heard of it?
No.
Oh, I don't know how far you are from you can get there. It's called the Hill of the Cross. I'd never heard of it. It is simply, look it up. The Hill of the Cross. It is simply stunning. Apparently in the 15th century or 14th century, somebody, some priest or noble or whatever got the idea, or they saw an apparition on this hill, and they put a crucifix there. And then other people started coming, and then more. There are millions of them. Big, tall, small, wide, gold, silver, wood, pewter, pearl, you name it. It's so large that they actually had to kind of organize it and try to make pathways through it all. But it began as one man planning a cross. So where you're at in Austria, and with the Cistercian sisters, is this a large? Is this an old? Can you just give us a little background on the actual convent?
So it's actually a men's community.
Oh, it's a men's community. Okay.
Yeah, and founded in 1133. And has been...
Wait a minute, was it founded by St. Bernard then?
No, it wasn't.
Because that's in his wheelhouse right there, 1133, I think.
Yeah, very early community, and it's amazing given how much persecution there's been of monasteries in Europe, and then the secularism with monasteries sort of collapsing. But this one has maintained its presence and practice, and it's a thriving men's community that also has a school of theology and a seminary attached to it. And I'm fortunate right now to be able to live next door.
So you're studying theology then, obviously.
Well, it's actually a great temptation here that I've got to resist a little because my work is really the translations I'm doing.
Okay.
Author Ida Gouris. I'd actually love to spend my days attending the lectures at the school, but I can only fit in a few. But I'm a visiting researcher there, and also, you know, basically become part of the community through our, you know how it is when people go to daily mass and it's always the same people and you get to know each other and then you start doing things together like going to pray the rosary in public.
So now, 3 weeks ago, I interviewed Alexander Teshugawal, and he is at the Boniface Institute. And so that's in a different part of Austria, because I think he's more near to, or maybe he's on the other side of Vienna. And he told me that he didn't say he started it, but that he was assisting in these Wednesday rosaries, these marches. So they're not just happening where the wine merchant, Louis-Pierre LaRoche, not just happening where Louis-Pierre LaRoche is doing it. They're happening in many places in Austria. Is that right?
Well, sort of like two streams are related. I think they're separate, but they've come into contact. So Alexander Teshugawal and some others have been doing this great effort in Vienna to have public rosary processions in Vienna. And I've gone to participate in some of those with others from Heiligen Kreuz. But 3 weeks ago, Louis-Pierre LaRoche in Austria started public rosaries in his own village and called others to do the same in their own villages where they're at. And so what's come now is that there's now weekly rosaries, and it's right where people are at in their own towns, villages, and cities, not just in the capital once a month. And so it's spread across the country now.
Now, we'll wrap this up in a minute. So in the last, the penultimate paragraph of, well, first of all, you mentioned two priests that have given homilies about this. So two brave, courageous priests who are probably defying bishops and who are talking about it. You want to talk a little bit about them?
Well, I think it's really encouraging that priests are stepping up, speaking about this, and one that I mentioned, it was on a Sunday in Advent when the gospel reading was about St. John the Baptist, you know, being a voice in the desert, and the priest said to us, today we need to go out and be a voice in the desert. It was really encouraging, and he told people during his sermon about this new prayer initiative, and he put the website for the new prayer initiative here. It's called Austria Prays, and he put the website on the little, you know, piece of paper with the hymns for the Sunday.
Right.
And said, go out. And he also said, come join us. And it's interesting for me to watch here in our town. It was a group of men who got together and said, we're going to organize this. And it was really encouraging to see these men take leadership and bring this about. And that photo in with my article,
right.
I'm in that photo somewhere in the back. And that photo was right here in the town I'm in.
Okay, so the second question is, and then we'll wrap up on this. You mentioned in the article that one of the encouraging things that's come out of this, for example, in your Telegram messaging, is that this is not a we're all good traddy people here. This is not a singular monolithic Catholic, we have to do this movement. You've got your Novus, your New Rite of Mass. You've got your traditionalists. You have some others, but there doesn't seem to be any quarrel amongst anyone here. Is that right?
I have to say, compared to some of the internal quarreling that I'm a bit used to, it's really striking to me how absent that is. And instead, there's a focus. We're going to go do one thing. We're going to pray together on Wednesday nights in public. We're going to pray the rosary, and we're going to pray for Austria. And keeping it focused on that, and it's a time of great need, has brought people out. And it's also an opportunity to pray for unity in the church, for authentic unity. You know, we're not going to achieve it overnight, but we can go out and be Catholic together in public, rooted in tradition with this great tradition of the rosary.
Now, you said when we first started this, you're a convert.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. I was thinking that you were cradle falling away, but you're a convert.
Yeah.
When? So how long is the conversion?
So, nutshell, 1990 is when I came into the church, and the real catalyst for me was when I studied Marxism-Leninism in East Germany in the 80s. And the Polish students were an incredible witness to me. They were so courageous. And studying Marxism-Leninism also led me to have an encounter with God, and I realized whatever was going on in these Polish students' lives had something to do with that, and here I am.
Okay. Well, we're glad you came. So how long were you, do you think you found a home now in Austria?
Well, I'm at a think tank, the Ethics and Public Policy Center in D.C. My current project is for 2 years. Mm. So I'm half a year into it, a year and a half to go. And what I'm going to do next, I would ask, please pray for me. I'm looking for God's guidance about where I'll go next. But I'm here right now.
All right. Jennifer Bryson, live from Heiligenkreuz, Austria. I got it. Heiligenkreuz. No, Sugarwell had me screaming like a German at the end of the conversation.
The Austrians are a little mellower.
Well, the Germans, it sounds like they're yelling at you all the time. Even when they're not yelling at you, it sounds kind of like they're yelling at you. Well, there is such a great tradition. Obviously, the House of Habsburg and the royalty and the monarchies of Christendom. You won't get those stories without hearing Austria or Austro-Hungarian Empire of some sort. So look, as I have been saying. I actually told John Henry Weston of Lifeside News. He didn't know this. I broke the news to him. I'm like, Catholic Lithuania, 95% of Lithuanians are baptized Catholics. About a third or two-thirds of them are confirmed. If they can get away with the passports and the soft communism in Catholic Lithuania, we're doomed. But then again, I think that, well, no, maybe that's by Beelzebub's design. Because this has a 30,000-foot satanic imprint all over it. These people that are orchestrating this, the political class, they're too stupid to have pulled this off on their own. So that's the thing where, and who is it that crushes the head of that serpent? It's Our Lady. The rosary is, and as she promised the father in the 1950s, do what I tell you to do and there will be peace. Hmm? She didn't say it. She didn't put an expiration date on it like it was a Budweiser. Peace will expire. And as I said, the error probably is that we stop. And we should never stop. So, all right, Jennifer, well, God bless you. And thanks for stopping by and being generous with your time today. Always good to see and to hear from you. We should not, it's been 2 years. We shouldn't go so far in between correspondence.
All right, and I wish you a blessed Christmas.
A blessed Christmas to you and a remainder of Advent. We still have Ember Saturday to get through here.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Jennifer, God bless you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. Correspondence.
All right, and I wish you a blessed Christmas.
A blessed Christmas to you and a remainder of Advent. We still have Ember Saturday to get through here.
Oh, yeah.
All right, Jennifer, God bless you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.